It's hour two of the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Just to remind you, you can call us on 07491 25000, 00353 749125000. If you're outside the dialing area, text or WhatsApp us on 086 60 25000. Email comments at highlandradio.com. We'd love to hear from you on your take on the issues of the day. Just a few of the comments that have been coming in. Gwibara Conservation Group have been in touch. Beg your pardon. They say the mast outside Duhuri has a 5-year planning permission until September 2025. The mast was erected by Gale Force, but the thermal spectrum camera belongs to Spuri of Oslo, Norway. And that's from the Gwibara Group, and thank you very much to the group there. Caller says, Donal, I was at the AC/DC gig. It was my first time to see them. It was a brilliant show. Jammed, huge crowd, great atmosphere. The finale was a firework display that came from behind the stage. And if they did what I know they certainly did at the last two gigs I was at, and did quite a bit, as they finish off with "For Those About to Rock," and they have six cannons on the stage, and they go, "For those about to rock, fire," and cannons go off, and we, great stuff indeed. That's from Gary D. And Gary, I'm glad you had an absolute ball. I know some of my mates were there, and they brought their children, and I hope they had a blast. Connor says, I know yesterday what happened at the Church of the Irish Martyrs was despicable. The poor woman that was having a first anniversary mass for her late husband was really upset, said she was mortified and disgusted by what was happening. I don't know. Parishioners were scared, annoyed and upset. And that's absolutely, and your heart goes out to someone in that situation. Caller says, is democracy working when 72% of people say they want very strict limits on immigration, yet the government and media treat their wishes with contempt? Well, the caller says this morning the paper has published the amount of people who have claimed from a number of councils. And as we said, the Donegal figure was 97 claims last year, and the figure was just over £1.7 million in payouts. The caller says, would there be so many claims if your name was published? This should not come under GDPR. It's public money. It would help stop some of these get-rich-quick schemes. A distressing story. Caller says, my home place was egged and locks were broken on sheds. A window was smashed and a pull cord was pulled on the lawnmower in the house, and that happened on Wednesday of last week. It was my dad's second anniversary, with an anniversary mass taking place shortly afterwards. We had got the place painted up. It shows you the kind of people we have running around, and it's really distressing when you read stories like that, and really sorry for that caller, and hope that you were able to honour your dad in the best way possible, despite the upset of having that happen. Caller says, I don't go to the doctors very often, but I was in terrible pain this past few days. I went to the medical centre with a urine sample. I asked if I could see the nurse. No, she's on holiday. I then said to the receptionist, I just want to get a urine sample checked, to which she replied, we don't do that anymore. She went on to say that the next emergency appointment was 10 past four that evening. So firstly, is this right that they don't do urine samples now, since when? Secondly, how does a receptionist determine what is an emergency? Not a bit wonder that people are seriously ill with a system like this. I think what the receptionist was saying was, look, that the next doctor's appointment available was 10 past four that afternoon. I would suggest, and I have no wish to appear in any way facetious, caller, I really don't, but I think if anyone is in a situation where they feel they're in an emergency and they can't get a GP appointment that quickly, then I would suggest we do have an accident and emergency department in the hospital, and maybe go there. Now, I know it's easy to say there's an A&E at the hospital when you're in Letterkenny and the hospital is just down the road, and it may well be, I don't know where this caller is from, it may well be this caller is from Glencolumbkill, this caller could be from anywhere in the county, I absolutely appreciate that, but I would say we know how difficult it is to get appointments with GPs. I would say with all sincerity, if you feel you're in an emergency situation, I would be inclined to go to the emergency department at the hospital. Let's go to a topic that is a regular one on this programme and right across the board on Highland Radio and elsewhere, that of safety of children online. We're joined on Zoom this morning by Alex Cooney, who is the CEO of CyberSafe Kids. Alex, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, we know the gaming platforms are set to fall under the radar of a new media regulator, though, according to a cyber expert, but the EU's Digital Services Act is attracting some pushback, it would appear, from some of the big companies.
Well, sure. I mean, if there's resistance to regulation, it's not surprising. And I think it's been there for a long time. But, you know, we are entering hopefully a new phase where regulation is the norm. We have the Online Safety Media Regulation Act in Ireland. We have the Digital Services Act, as you've mentioned, at the European level. And a lot of the very big companies that people will recognize, Google, Meta, TikTok, and so on, they fall, Amazon, they fall under the definition of the services that will be the very large online platforms that the Digital Services Act will be regulating. But our concern is that some of the services, particularly the ones that are popular with children, don't come under that regulation or they're not quite big enough to sort of meet the threshold.
In terms of the content in some online games that are played, I'm certainly of an age where a computer game when I was young was basically Donkey Kong or Pac-Man or something like that, and that was the cutting edge of technology. Now, the actual graphics are frighteningly realistic. And in many cases, the content that they're portraying is nothing less than horrific.
There is some very graphic content, and, you know, aside from anything, we know that children in primary school are playing over 18s games in some cases. I think last year it was about 30% of the boys that we surveyed between the ages of 8 and 12 were playing over 18s games. And obviously that contains adult content, you know, horror, terror, violence and sexual content in some cases as well. But even games with much younger age ratings that, you know, maybe 7 or so on, could still have that facility to engage with people you don't know. You know, for example, an enormously popular online platform is Roblox, which does have that younger age rating. And you have the ability to meet with people you don't know. There's the ability to upload content. You know, it's like a multiplayer universe. And I think it seems safe, but in fact doesn't come under Digital Services Act because it doesn't have the monthly user number is something like 30 million, whereas the threshold was 45 million. So, you know, who is regulating or properly keeping a close eye and scrutinizing those sorts of platforms where children are gathering in very large numbers?
What reason was given for not bringing those smaller companies in under the regulatory banner?
I think the Digital Services Act wanted to focus on the really big ones, the really big names. But I think almost we need to look at where we almost need to treat these children differently in these online spaces, you know, much in the way that we have offline.
Yeah.
You know, if you think of something like a playground, you know, there are actually regulations and, you know, best practice approaches to how you create a playground so that it is safe and enjoyable for children, that they can make most of the experience. We need to create these safer online spaces, for children. And in fact, we need to be looking at where are children gathering in large numbers. And we can see from our data that we run each year, the trends and usage data, which we'll be launching actually in a couple of weeks for this last academic year. And we see where they are. The online environments that they're inhabiting, it's YouTube, it's Snapchat, it's TikTok, it's Roblox, it's Fortnite.
Yeah.
These are the places. So we need to almost look at, okay, well, what are let's not look at the whole user base. Let's look at specifically where children are and regulate accordingly, because there is a greater onus on them to ensure children are going to be protected in those online spaces in a way that they simply aren't at the moment. And we all know that.
The difference in many ways between a playground and an online space is a playground, a parent can physically go watch their children in the playground and will know what the dangers are, will know where the pitfalls are, and are able to watch and understand what their child is doing. The reality in many, many cases online is that the children will know a lot more about accessing things online and being online and how to navigate online than the parents do. And I suspect in many cases, parents don't know what's going on online because they just don't have the capacity, they don't have the knowledge. The reality is our children have far surpassed our knowledge in terms of what's out there and how to get around any barriers.
Yeah, I mean, we have huge sympathy for parents. You know, like, obviously one of our messages is that you know, as parents and carers, you do really need to engage in your children's online lives. It's really important, especially when they're younger. you know, that you're having those conversations, you're putting in those parental controls, you're keeping an eye on them, you're keeping them where you can see them, you know, you're checking in with them and you're checking those devices, especially when they're younger. But there's no question that the job of parents is made so much harder by the way that these online environments are created, the fact that they are designed for engagement, to hold engagement for as long as possible, which makes it really difficult for an adult to put down a device, never mind a child. So it's really frustrating to us that that parents' job is made so much harder, and that children in some cases are helped to hide information from their parents, you know, on WhatsApp, for example. You know, they can hide messages, you know, which is understandable when children age and get into their teens and need more privacy, need more independence. But if children are using those services younger, then it's really important that parents, there's an open line of communication with parents and that they can see what's happening online for children.
Cora says games are certified in age groups. Parents should be in control of their children and what games they're playing, surely. They can't go out and buy an 18-rated movie in a shop, nor should they be able to buy an 18-rated game. And that would be absolutely true if our children were going into shops and physically buying 18-rated games. I mean, all I can see, certainly any of the big game retailers appear to be closing down because all the games are now accessed and sold online. I mean, I don't know when I have a son who's, well, he's substantially older than a child, but I can't remember when he last actually bought a physical game. All his purchases now of games are online.
And we have self-declaration of age. I mean, that's the extent to which we have to prove our age. We say what age we are and in we go, you know, and that's by and large how you get access to these online services. You know, even since the GDPR was introduced in the digital age of consent back in 2018. It's made very little difference to children's ability to sign up for services when they're under the minimum age requirement. So we need much more stringent measures to ensure that children are going to be protected. You know, the fact that children can sign up with a fake age to, for example, a porn site is just crazy. So, you know, it is long overdue that we need age verification put in place, age verification that is going to protect the rights and preserve the privacy of the child. But we do urgently need much more stringent measures to protect children from some of this more inappropriate adult content that is available to them online.
Are services like NetNanny is one I recall, there were other services as well, Safeguarding Children. Are they still available? Are they still effective?
There are absolutely parental controls. There's a whole thriving parental control market. But actually, we did a survey of parents earlier that we released it in February, and we found quite a low number. Only 28% said they use parental controls, which I find confusing, I suppose, because it seems to me an obvious thing to do. Of course, it's not a silver bullet. No parental control is a silver bullet. You need to have the conversations. You need to have that engagement as well. But they are an extremely useful tool in the toolkit of any parent. So I would urge any parent that has a child who is active online, especially in that younger age bracket, to ensure that they've got the minimum things. You can do things at device level. You can do things at app level. You can do things at network level. So there are lots of opportunities. And do you know, if you're not feeling very confident about being able to apply them, honestly, a simple search will, you know, often give you the step-by-step process through which to put those parental controls in place. You know, for example, and you know, using things like Safe Search and whatever safe search browser you're using, and ensuring that whatever devices they're on has that enabled. You know, you can do things like turn off autoplay on YouTube, which stops that kind of continuous stream of recommended content over which you have very little control, because they're determining based on engagement what the next video is going to be. So I would urge any parent listening to certainly use parental controls at a minimum.
Are we in a situation where a lot of the regulations were designed many, many years ago at a time when there was maybe one central computer in a house and everyone accessed the same computer? So parents would have had a lot more control over that computer. The reality now is everyone has at least one, and in some cases two and possibly three different devices, not to mention the fact that Game Boy is online, Xbox is online, PlayStation is online. That, I mean, it could conceivably, there could be a child in your house that has online access on four different devices.
Absolutely. And in fact, when we survey children, we ask them what devices they have, their own devices, and we're very clear in the question, this is not a family device, this is your device specifically. And lots of children have multiple devices. They could have a tablet, games console, VR headset, and a smartphone. You know, in fact, for 8 to 10 year olds, the most popular device is a tablet, followed by a games console rather than a smartphone. So actually, some of the kind of debate that we have around smartphones is a bit misleading, because actually it's not the device of choice for younger children. And yet it has all the same capability. And any child in a bedroom with a door shut on a device that can connect to the internet is potentially vulnerable. So I think we need to broaden out that discussion. And to your point about, you know, has this got very complicated? It's not so simple as, you know, one device in a household. It is complicated. There is no question. It's a highly complex area. Even talking about something like age verification, you know, I've been reminded many times that this is not just a straightforward, you know, one size fits all approach. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, we have to do far more to protect children online. It's many times been described as a Wild West, and that's exactly what it is for children. And we've got to change that, because it's impacting on childhood. You know, there are many benefits to growing up in the digital age, and we completely acknowledge that as an organization. But we feel that children are not able to thrive in the digital world until we address some of these very inherent risks that they face online.
Is there a risk that we are sowing the seeds of problems now through inaction, and in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time, we're going to be reaping a whirlwind as a result?
I mean, I think if you were to put that question to the government, they would say, well, we are responding. We've put in place this Online Safety and Media Regulation Act. We have Commissioner Mann. We have an Online Safety Commissioner under Commissioner Mann. So, you know, we've got the first online safety code in draft form that's sitting with the European Commission. And that is all for sure progress. It's you know, in theory, the era of self-regulation is over. But it will remain to be seen how impactful it is. And, you know, obviously our hope is that it's highly impactful. But for children, to our mind, it likely does not go far enough. So we will be watching this with interest and urging that there are more child-specific measures put in place. And certainly we want to see the Online Safety Code reviewed within 2 years of it of being put in place, because we want to know that it's working, that the threat of fines and so on really are making a difference to how these companies operate. Because at the end of the day, they're putting profit over user safety.
The threat of fines, is that going to be enough? Because one of the big worries about things like the Digital Services Act, and particularly when you move into self-regulation, is will those regulations have teeth? And if the only recourse to government is a fine, which could be perceived as a slap on the wrist, is that going to be enough?
It depends. I mean, you know, they are talking about quite hefty fines. There's even talk about personal liability in the cases of some leaders in these companies. So, it's hard to say at this point. It really will depend, you know, when these breaches occur and kind of how what the response is to those breaches. You know, it needs to change, and we don't have a lot of time. We can't be dragging our feet over this. Children are at risk today. Their rights are being undermined every time they go online. So we urgently need these changes.
One question, caller says, I have my son at the weekend. Can I install anything that would limit his access on his phone or tablet?
Yeah, I mean, it depends what he's got. So obviously the device type is important. If you are both using Apple, for example, you can pair the device and use the family sharing. There's a similar offering with Android devices. So I would urge that parent to sit down and literally set it up, you know, look at how, because you can limit time, you can limit downloads, you can filter to an appropriate age. You know, so there's lots of very simple things you could do at a basic level. And I would encourage that parent to explore what they can do.
Alex Cooney, it's a really, really important issue. And thanks indeed for speaking to us this morning. I will be watching with interest. And hopefully this Digital Services Act and the new Commissioner Mann regulations will be effective, and our kids will be safer out there. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
That's Alex Cooney there, the CEO of CyberSafe. It's the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Now, I'm going to go to line one and Senator Malcolm Byrne. Senator Byrne, good morning.
Good morning, and good morning to your listeners.
Now, we all basked in the glory and enjoyment of the Irish performance at the Olympics in Paris, and it was a wonderful 2 weeks of sport and a wonderful 2 weeks showcasing the country. And you believe that Ireland could be hosting the Summer Olympics in the future. We need to look ahead, as far ahead as 2072.
Yes, John. So I made this call like everybody else. You know, I saw our wonderful athletes in Paris, and that was down, you know, their achievements was down to their hard work, but also the high performance units, the investment in sports that we've seen over the last number of years, and that led to the most successful Olympics that Ireland has ever had. And I think we need to start to think about how we in Ireland can host big international events. We've done it in the past. If you think about the biggest sporting event in the world in 2003 was the Special Olympics, which was held in Ireland. And I've made the suggestion that we look not in the near future, but into the distant future with the idea and objective of Ireland hosting the biggest show on earth, the Summer Olympics. And I know there's probably a few of your listeners are rolling their eyes at this, but if you cast your mind back, and I know most of your listeners will be too young to do this, to Ireland in the 1970s, and if you can imagine the transformation of Ireland from the 1970s to today, think about how Ireland could be transformed over the next 50 years. And we've got to, I believe, have that kind of long-term planning and that kind of debate around the sort of society we want to see in the future. We often debate the constitutional future of this island, but really I think what we need to talk about is the communities we want, the infrastructure we want. I'd love to see a situation where every child and young person in Ireland and every community has access to great sporting, cultural and community facilities, and that at a national level, for our elite sports people, that they have top-class global facilities in which to train and indeed to compete.
One of the problems is at the moment we don't have a velodrome, we don't have a 50-metre pool, but we believe there is a 50-metre pool in storage while a group in Cork tries to get a place to actually put it in. So they have the pool, but they don't have the site in which to place it. It would take a huge investment in things like velodromes and pools to get an Olympics up and running. And that's not even to mention the increase there'd need to be in bed capacity and hotels between now and then. It's a huge piece of infrastructural work. Do you believe we have the capacity and we have the determination to take that on and achieve it?
Well, here's the question. Do we as Irish people believe in ourselves? Are we prepared to make the investment in that infrastructure to host those kind of events? We're hosting the Euros jointly with the UK in a couple of years. That's the third biggest sporting event in the world. Yes, we are behind in terms of some areas of sporting infrastructure. We're finally starting to see the National Velodrome being developed. Next month, Sports Minister Thomas Byrne will announce a record $250 million in sports capital funding, which would be to sports clubs all over the country. But he'll also be announcing $120 million in what's called the Large-Scale Sporting Infrastructure Fund, which will be towards you know, national sporting infrastructure, a very big regional sporting infrastructure. There's a new national swim strategy about to be put in place. So, yes, there are 50-metre pools at UCD, at Abbotts, at Blanchardstown, and also in the University of Limerick. There's obviously the one that's going to be built in Cork. But as part of this national swim strategy, it's going to be trying to ensure that everybody in Ireland has easy access to a swimming pool. Because swimming is you know, it's as you know, it's the second most active individual sport after walking or running. And we should encourage everybody to have access to it. What I'm talking about, though, is the long-term planning at which the stage is often not very good, looking and setting ourselves a goal that Ireland will have among the best sports facilities in the world, that we recognise our elite athletes, and that we look to host some of the biggest sporting events in the world.
In most cases, athletes from Northern Ireland were competing under the Irish banner, and we know people like Rory McIlroy, for instance, even though they would be perhaps from a unionist background themselves, they play for Ireland because they were supported as budding athletes and in their formative years by the Irish sporting body. And that's been the case with McIlroy and many others. I think there was something like 58 athletes from Northern Ireland in Paris, and of those, something like 51 or 52 actually competed under the Irish banner. With that in mind, are you looking north and thinking, right, obviously Dublin might be the focus, but are we looking at going north, be it to Casement or be it to other areas around about Northern Ireland as well, and making this an all-Ireland bid rather than just a Republic of Ireland bid?
Well, that's the point I've been making. I've been talking about the island of Ireland. We're a small enough island. There should be greater cooperation. And rather than us, you know, often debating constitutional issues and structures around, you know, how a parliament might work in this island in the future, what real cooperation we can see is when it comes to sporting events. And we've seen that in the past. I think we should be rightly proud of all of those athletes from our island, whether they competed for Team Ireland or Team GB. You know, they inspire us. They give us so much enjoyment. And we need to continue to support them and invest in high-performance training and infrastructure. But let's be ambitious for this country. I think one of the criticisms that's often made about politicians and others is that we think too short-term. We need to start to think about what kind of Ireland we want to create over the next 50 years. And I certainly think in areas like sporting and cultural and artistic infrastructure, we shouldn't apologise for wanting the best on this island. And again, I come back to the point about, you know, when I say that we start to think about possibly hosting the Olympics in 2072, I say go back to the 1970s. Think about how Ireland has utterly transformed in the last 50 years. And now try to imagine how we can transform this island of ours over the next half century.
No, well, personally, I was 16 when the 70s ended. So if I am to see Summer Olympics in 2072, I'll have to live to be 108. I'm not sure that's going to happen, but certainly, as you said, it is going to take a lot of planning. And you believe that planning needs to start now?
It absolutely should start now. And I think we should involve today's young people. So those who are going to be collecting their leaving search results very soon, including those in Donegal, they're likely to be working until the 2070s. They're going to be living until the 2090s. And on current projections, one in five of them will see the 22nd century. We should involve those young people. You know, the imagination, the inspiration of so many young people around the country. Get them to start to talk about, you know, how they want to shape Ireland, the kind of international events we want to bring here. And I've no doubt, I mean, if you look at young people, how they rise to the challenge, whether it's in sport or the arts, or in things like the BT Young Scientists or Young Social Innovators, we all know great young people within our communities. Let's challenge and involve young people to shape that Ireland that we want to see over the next half century.
It's an interesting challenge and certainly an interesting issue to discuss, Senator Malcolm Byrne. Thank you very much indeed and a very good morning to you.
And to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's an interesting one, and we, I suppose, need to be ambitious. I mean, it's an idea that's been floated before. I seem to recall Richard Bruton was very much speaking about Olympics in Dublin in the past, as was Jim Mitchell, an MEP, and Mitchell and Bruton were both sort of pushing it big time a couple of years back. And hey, it might happen. There's no reason why it shouldn't, but as we said, it would take huge investment in hotels, huge investment in facilities. But they do say that having the Olympics in a city can absolutely transform that city. One of my favourite cities in Europe is Barcelona. And I think you can actually see the difference that the Olympics was at 92, they were held in Barcelona. But the difference those Olympics in Barcelona in 92 made to the city is staggering. And to this day, you can see where the Olympic Village was and how that's now been purposed into accommodation for local people and so on. So, I mean, yeah, it's a big ambition. As I say, unless I live to be 108, I won't see it. But hey, perhaps my grandchildren will. I'm going to go to line one because we're joined by a journalist that I would have read a lot over the years, and that's Patsy McGarry, who was the Irish Times religious correspondent since 1997. Patsy has published his life story in a book called Well, Holy God. Now, I can tell you my children, if I said to them, well, holy God, they wouldn't have a clue where that phrase came from. Those of us of a certain age will know, of course, exactly where the phrase, well, holy God, came from. But Patsy McGarry, a very good morning to you.
You too, Donald. You know where it came from. It came from Miley.
It did indeed. Well, all he got. The great
Mick Lally, the great Mick Lally.
Indeed, yeah, and a fantastic actor he was too, sadly taken way before his time.
And a lovely man.
I met him once, and again, he was up here a few times, and I had the pleasure of interviewing him once, and a great, great man. Patsy, your own story is an interesting one. You became the Irish Times Religious Affairs Correspondent in 1997, and that was around about the time a lot of the big stories in terms of abuse began to develop, a lot of the big stories in terms of dealing with our past began to come into the public consciousness, and they developed over and escalated over the course of the intervening years. But before we go there, take us back to yourself as a youth, a young man out of school, a man with some faith, a man looking at the world ahead. What did you envisage for yourself as you were picking up the first pen, hitting the first keys on a typewriter, and making your first forays into journalism?
Well, I suppose this really is not really a memoir in the broader sense of the word, or what people would expect. It's what the publishers have described as a professional memoir. In other words, that part of my life which is relevant to the job I had. And in that context, I thought it only fair that people should know where I came from myself in terms of belief. And really, the first two chapters are about growing up in rural northwest Roscommon, a place called Mullen, which was about a mile and a half from French Park, out literally in the countryside, where I spent the first 10 years of my life. In a very traditional rural Irish setting, we moved into Ballyhadrin in the early 1960s, which was a movement across planets, even almost universes, to a small town there where it's still very close to my heart. And how my own, I was a very devout young fellow. I believed well into my teens, if not into late teens, that I was going to have a vocation for the priesthood. And then began to ask questions. And increasingly the answers were less and less and less and less satisfactory. And I had to be honest with myself and say, well, this is not working for me. It was a very difficult process. I describe it in the book as a process of bereavement rather than I didn't ditch my faith. I lost it.
Yeah.
And with great reluctance because of the huge positive force in my life. But I had to face up to the facts of the beliefs of the existence as I saw them and live accordingly or try to do so. So basically by the time I was a young adult, I was what's described as an agnostic. As I say in the book, I am Irish and Catholic by cultural background, but agnostic through lack of conviction, and that is my position, and was my position when I went for this job. And I told the people who were interviewing me for the job as Religious Affairs Correspondent that I was an agnostic, but I asked them, would you appoint a member of a political party as a political correspondent? And I don't know whether that worked or not, but I got the job.
It's an interesting one because obviously religion deals with issues of faith and issues of spirituality and esoteric issues like that. But the reality is, as a religious affairs correspondent, you're dealing with religious structures, and religious structures are very much made up of people with all their foibles and all their failings.
Yeah, and I mean, I came from, if you like, covering politics into covering religion. And of course, as you know, those two were very intertwined in Ireland, particularly were back then in the 1990s, especially so. And so I decided to apply the same skills, or whatever you want to call them, in dealing with the church figures, leading church figures, as I would to leading politicians. Ask them the same sort of questions, not be disrespectful, but without deference. And I mean, sadly, I would have thought anyhow prior to that was an over-deferential attitude towards political leaders, bishops, etc., in the past, which didn't help them. And it certainly didn't help the wider public, not least in the light of what did emerge from the 1990s on in terms of the Catholic Church particularly, but not just the Catholic Church. I think they should be held, church leaders should be held to account in the same way as political leaders are held to account. And they are answerable or should be answerable to the people, not just to God or the Pope in Rome. And that was the position I took.
Did any bishop or priest take exception to the fact that you were questioning them as you would a minister or a frontbench spokesperson?
Well, I think, I mean, a lot of the older ones were not used to this sort of interrogation, if you like. I mean, and being questioned in this sceptical fashion. And they did take exception to it. I mean, the role of the media in general is, the media is a fairly recent institution in terms of society at large. It's only about 300 years old. And often, even still, among the older institutions like the churches, etc., they are seen as sort of upstarts or Johnny's come lately. Who do these guys think they are? But we are part of modern society, especially in a democracy. We have a role of holding people to account. And that is our job. And fine, they get used to it. The younger clergy don't have much a problem with it because they grew up in that culture. Older bishops, particularly older church leaders, did. But that was the job.
As I said, when you took the position of religious affairs correspondent with the Irish Times, it was 1997, and that was around about the time we began to realise the scale of child abuse cases and the scale of the issue. And as the years went on, more and more revelations appeared. We had the infamous cases like the Brendan Smith case and others, the cases in Wexford, and then more and more it came out. And the more that was happening, you were obviously at the core of writing about it, of looking into it. How difficult was that to cover as someone who, while agnostic, would still have traditionally had a faith in the Catholic Church, would still have felt a place in the Catholic Church? How difficult is it to be covering an institution that you would have had so much involvement in over the years, and now suddenly you're seeing the extent to which it has feet of clay?
Well, I suppose to underline how novel, if you want to use that unfortunate word, probably in the context, this abuse issue was at the start of my period as religious affairs correspondent. I took on the job in March of 1997. In August of that year, Brendan Smith was jailed here in the Republic for 13 years for the abuse of children here in this part of the island. He had already done time in Belfast from 1993 for the abuse of children in Belfast itself, in the Falls Road area, neighbours of his own, as it happened. But like a lot of other people, I thought Brendan Smith was a once-off. I thought he was an aberration. I had no idea of the tsunami that was coming out or about to emerge. I mean, as more and more people have been abused, began to go public about their abuse, it just generated. It became almost self-generating. It gave courage to other people who've been abused to come forward, and it just built up and up and up. The church authorities made a mess of it, of course. They basically, what became very, very clear is that the priority for them was protection of the institution, not the children who have been abused by priests. And often in instances, they have more concern for the priest who was accused than for the child who was abused. And the most stark illustration of that was that in 1987, when the bishops were first alerted to the possibility of this happening in Ireland, as it had already happened in America, it began to emerge. The story began there in Louisiana in 1984, when a priest was exposed to having abused children, and the cover-up by his bishop was even more starkly exposed. What did the Irish bishops do when warned this is going down the line? In 1987, they did one thing. They took out insurance and nothing else until 1996, 9 years later, when they published their first guidelines. And that illustrates precisely where their priorities lay. It was with protecting the institution.
The work that you and others as journalists were doing at that time to expose all that was absolutely vital in ensuring that all this came to light. Were you conscious at the time of the importance of what you were doing?
Well, could I go a bit further and say that the real heroes of this are not people like me. It's the men and women who came forward to tell their stories. And that was a desperately difficult thing for them to do, especially back then, where people, the element of doubt was serious and strong, and they faced a huge opposition from loyal Catholics particularly, and indeed from the institution itself. And I suppose people like myself, who believed them and stood by them because the evidence was there, it was stark, that was our role, if you like. We reported what they said, that we carried their stories, but they are the people who exposed the abuse, the people who were abused. Starting with Andrew Madden in 1995, who was the first man to go public about his abuse here in Dublin, as happened by Father Andrew Payne, Ivan Payne, who has since been laicized. And then other people like Colin McGorman, who exposed his abuse by Father Sean Fortune in Ferns Diocese, which led to a documentary in 2002, which in turn led to the Ferns Inquiry, which was the very first of five statutory inquiries into the abuse of children by clergy in this republic.
And he, of course, went on to form one in four as well.
That's right, he started one in four. And of course, your own county, was at the coal face when it came to abuse and the cover up of abuse there. I mean, there are some shocking stories from Rovaulx Diocese, covered up by at least two bishops particularly. And I remember confronting one of them, Bishop Hegarty, when he'd moved on to Derry, where he also had a similar pattern of cover-up. And his attitude to people like me was, bring it on, bring it on. I remember he actually used that phrase in Maynooth one occasion when I asked him about allegations and allegations.